And we're back for more Profiling Criminal Minds, the only show to go in-depth in America's favorite show about serial killers. I'm Dan, joined by...
Sheila.
And we are here to talk about what I would argue are the two most important episodes of the first season, and they aired back-to-back. One is more important than the other, but the other is pretty interesting as well. But before we get there, I believe you have some news about the FBI on television.
Okay, I was just going to say that it's very strange. This season there are two new shows about the FBI.
Well, I don't know, what was the show about the tattooed lady?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay,
I didn't watch it.
You're the one.
I know the one you're talking about, but that wasn't even worth it.
About the FBI, and then, of course, there was Quantico, which was about the FBI, but that went off the air as well.
Yeah, that's off the air. That's gone, but that...
I'm saying those two shows have cleared the way for new shows about the FBI.
Well, yeah, except that one, right, is getting massive publicity. The FBI. It's called FBI, and everybody is raving about it, apparently.
Yeah.
It is... by CBS, which leads me to wonder whether or not they're running this so they can replace Criminal Minds with this.
Oof.
Do you know what I mean?
No, yeah, I get it.
Okay.
Now, and it's by Dick Wolf, creator of Law & Order.
God-awful show.
Okay. Wow, you're not mincing words on this one.
Oh,
Did it have a terrible pilot? Or
the pilot was terrible because all I could think of was, so they're already ripping off Criminal Minds?
That quickly?
The first episode is ripping off sort of the dual episode with Hotch. I don't even know if you've come across it yet. So it doesn't matter, like, on your reviews.
Right.
But there's a double episode with the guys who are trying to, you know, like the basic premise that what was
What's the plot
one?
Of the
okay,
episode?
The first one, there's a bomber.
Okay.
Right? So the first bomb goes off, and then all of the EMTs and everybody is going to go into the building to help. They've started to help try and clear the episode, and all of a sudden the FBI agent realizes
there's going to be another bomb. The real targets were the first responders.
Yeah, the first responders. God. And, I mean, and that's a Criminal Minds episode.
Yeah, no, there is one.
Yeah. Season four, season five, something like that.
Yeah.
After Hotch's marriage breaks up.
Yes.
Anyway, so there. And then this week we had the poisoning episode.
Oh, wow.
We've already discussed that.
Which
one.
We did last week, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and next week they're going to do a serial killer.
Oh, come on, guys.
Oh, good. And it's not good.
No.
It's no way. I mean, as I said, it's god-awful.
Okay.
Now, you know, mind you, apparently the reviews are wonderful. CBS is pushing this thing left, right, and center. Uh-huh. But I haven't checked its numbers yet.
Well, there's no accounting for taste. What was the other show that is FBI?
And the other show is called Gone. And it's like on City or Bravo or something.
Okay.
It's on one of the off little stations here.
Right.
It hasn't got much hype.
Yeah.
And it's the one that I watched the first episode. I think I mentioned it to you, where you have a child who had been kidnapped.
Okay.
By a couple, and they had been moving around. They were predators, this couple, and they kept the girl. And then she was finally rescued. They managed to rescue her by Chris Noth.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so he's playing like the Gideon Joe episode.
Playing that role on the team, yeah.
He's pulling the team together.
Right.
And you can believe him as an FBI agent.
Totally. 100%. He's Italian, he's Catholic, he's an FBI agent. Absolutely.
Yeah, right. You know? So what happens is that he puts together a team to find missing people, kidnapped victims.
Okay.
And he calls this girl in. Well, the first episode, I was, okay, but I'm willing to give it. The second one was much better. I haven't watched the third yet, but the second, there was a problem in the first episode with her coming into this team. There was this FBI agent who was, you know, who's a professional, right? And he doesn't like these amateurs because he's bringing her in, and one of her fellows, her friends, who was also had also been kidnapped by a pedophile, right? So they have this thing in common. The guy is, of course, the internet geek. He's
the Penelope of the group.
The Penelope of the group,
right.
And then she brings her special kind of skills, and he's trying to make her see that she understands predators beyond sexual predators of children in the second episode a little bit. So anyway, I have hopes actually for Gone.
Yeah.
FBI, I guess I'm going to have to watch their serial killer episode next week, but.
Yeah, but. We don't expect good things. Well, it's interesting, and they are doing a different kidnapping every week on Gone. Like it's a different.
Yeah,
so it's
a different type of kidnapping. Like the first one was just, of course, a child who had been very much her case, and so she was able, based on her experience, she went looking for things that, like this other guy who hated her and didn't want her on there,
might have missed. Right. Okay.
Well, he missed. Right.
Yeah,
and she knew what she was looking for, she said, because they've all got the hidey hole. Anyway, so that one, they're going to be different types of kidnapping. I don't know. And then the next one was, that was Girls. But anyway, I don't want to talk about it because we'll spend too much time on it.
Absolutely.
But I have hopes for Gone because it's very specific, trying to do things. It's got its issues. All of these shows have issues. But FBI, I'm going to have to watch it.
It's just truly dire. All right.
Okay.
All right, let's move on to the shows we're here to talk about. First off, Criminal Minds Season 1, Episode 14, Riding the Lightning. While investigating Florida husband and wife serial killers responsible for the gruesome murders of at least 18 teenage girls... interviewing, not investigating, my bad. Gideon suspects the wife is innocent and sets out to prove his theory before her execution date. The reason I say that this is one of the most important episodes of the entire show is, here in the first season, I think it's clear to say they weren't 100% clear on what the show was yet. Right? So they didn't have this strong rule about what is an episode of Criminal Minds. Now, we know what an episode of Criminal Minds is. We've seen hundreds of them. There's a dead body, right? Or occasionally a kidnapping, right? And then basically we just hang out with their search for that person, and then there's a second victim, and then there's a third victim, but that one gets rescued. Now, that they will, you know, change that up a little from time to time, mostly just by adding more victims. But that's pretty much all that you know it's true. Adding more victims is the one way they change that up.
Even in this episode.
Even in this episode. Which, by the way, the murders happened 14 years ago? They're still adding more victims.
Yeah,
criminal. I know. And in fact, we learned from the commentary, the episode was supposed to open with the body being found. They were actually... The funny part is, the way the episode was written was, they have to go and talk to the two of them, because another body gets found, right? And they need to know if there are more victims out there before they get executed. And what's interesting is, in the commentary you learned, like, yeah, people didn't need a justification for why they were going to interview them, so we just cut out that whole 10 minutes of the show. Because the show was, you know, the first cut of the show was an hour long, and they needed to find 15 minutes to cut out. And so that was an easy 10, was the whole why they're there.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice. I thought that was a good touch. And it's an interesting look behind the scenes at these guys. But yeah, I thought it's different because there's no ticking clock this time in the same way. Yeah, they're going to get executed at 1 minute after midnight, but... largely, there's not a pressure. There's not a time pressure on the characters, really. Nothing bad will happen if they don't get X done by Y date.
Right.
A woman whose level of involvement in a set of serial killings is debatable will die.
Yes.
That is all that is bad that will happen. And So, you know, I find it interesting that the show is mixing it up. They mix it up one other time this year by doing a single episode that's not about a serial killer. And that's right at the end, and we'll talk about that some more, because it's the last gasp of the original intention of what the show could be. Is like, oh, we'll do an episode that's about spies. But we'll talk about that when we get to it. There's still a lot of murder. It's very interesting, though. So this one is very different. I know it's one of your favorite episodes of Criminal Minds.
Yeah, it is. I mean, although, like, okay, because I wanted to ask you, do you still think it's a very weak episode after you've watched it again?
Well, here's the thing. I don't go back and read my reviews the first time that I did the first time through. Because I don't want to influence my thoughts on it as I'm rewatching them all. But I will say that I was very hard on this episode when I first watched it. I was. But the experience I'm having rewatching Criminal Minds is massively affected by the fact that I watched 8 more seasons of it. Like, each one worse than the last. So you go back and you watch this first season when there's the only way to describe it is like they were really trying things. They were trying to do different things. They were giving like real big actor showcases. Because Mandy and Michael Massey and who plays the wife?
Jeanetta Arquette.
Okay. Oh, there you go. Jeanetta Arquette, who's just amazing in the episode. She's got so much to do. She's so good in it. She so completely, like, commits to it and had her head shaved for the part, which is another good story from the commentary where it's like, we're going to put her in a scarf. And she's like, I shaved my head for this part. Like, you're going to put me in a scarf? Why did I shave my head if you're going to put a scarf on me? Which I thought was a very nice observation. But yeah, it's like really good performances by the actors, right? A really good performance by the actors, good setup. It's well written by the standards of Criminal Minds. And I don't want to damn with faint praise, because it's actually, it's pretty solid, except when you get to the standard, the serial, like, for a show that does it so much, they've never been particularly good at serial killers taunting investigators. Like, Michael Massey's a good performer, right? But it's just, there's nothing really to those scenes.
Well, you know, as an actor, he makes those scenes.
Work, yeah. I'm just saying.
He makes them work. He makes
that's
them work.
That's him. That's what I'm saying is him. It's not the script. It's him doing it. It's good for a Criminal Minds script, but what's happened here is, in the same way that they got Tony Todd for one scene to be the suicidally morose dad of a dead family, like, who massively elevates that part. I think Michael Massey elevates what would be a relatively throwaway part.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that I'm not sure, from what I've been watching. I've been watching Chris Cuomo has this show, and he talks to a couple of serial killers in it, right? And you don't see, and even BTK and the rest of it, the taunting that when they're face to face.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting sort of phenomena that the assumption is that serial killers will always taunt the police, that there's an assumption.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how
accurate
true
that is.
How truly accurate, even though they will say it, but when you start looking at it, and I've been reading now more and more of these, and I'm going, okay, these guys don't really, they're not self-aware enough to, in some ways, taunt.
Yeah. Especially since we're going to talk about BTK in a second, one of the few who really did. But yeah, like, so many of them, like, there's no, they don't really think of the cops involved in the case. You know, like, they'll do the cliched thing of trying to get close, and a lot of them have done that and volunteered on searches and whatnot, just because they want to know how the investigation is going. But none of the real guys seem to have that, oh, I feel like I have power over the cops because I'm standing right next to them and they don't know it. And then when they get caught, they, you know, continue to be defiant. That really doesn't seem to be much of a thing outside of fiction.
Yeah, I'm like, well, you know, it's like sometimes you can see, but involving themselves in, well, anyway, we'll talk just a sec, involving themselves in the hunt sometimes. Well,
yeah.
Maybe, maybe not. I think BTK was so out of the norm. But,
yeah.
Like, I'm just reading. It's funny because I watched it, when I watched it the second time, or the third time, I'm going, okay, the second time I was a little bit bored, and I've watched it now again, just yeah. yesterday or the day before.
To get ready for the show, like I did.
And then I'm going, okay, why was I bored the second time with parts of it? Well, parts of it were, well, parts of it are boring, actually.
Yeah, it's slow.
It's a slow episode, but it's not as bad. But I just, because I come to tears at the end of this episode every
yeah.
single time I watch it, that overrides.
Yeah, there's a lot of the critical thinking.
Yeah.
You'd have the episode otherwise.
This is also the episode, I think, that has the most comments on your blog.
It wouldn't surprise me. People love this episode, and I didn't like it the first time.
Yeah. And people, well, yeah, because there are reasons not to like it.
Yeah.
I also think people don't quite understand just what goes on. Like, it's interesting listening to the commentary. Because Simon Mirren, you know, talks about how women are more vilified than men.
Yeah.
And yet, for the most part, and you will see this, women don't. They may be more vilified in the press and everything else, but they don't get hard. Because what this is, this, you talk, I mean, this is Paul Bernardo in some ways and Carla Homolka, the
There's
Canadian.
A bit of that in here.
There's a bit of that in there, and somebody else brought up a couple from 78 to 80 in the States and California, where else?
Yeah.
California has a lot of them.
It does. It has yeah, the largest number of serial killers in America. Not per capita, but overall.
Yeah. Charlene and Gerald Gallego is what Galeo, they call
yeah.
It's, you know, she got off after 16 years. Carla Homolka got to change her name, and she got out.
Moved to Barbados or whatever.
Well, no. Well, I don't know if eventually she did, but she was in Montreal for a long time
yeah.
with her children. She had three children afterwards, and Oof. The whole thing.
No, we're not. Well, no. There's plenty of Carla Homolka episodes for us to get into that one based
yeah,
on.
Yeah, but except that this is almost doing the other thing. The biggest problem I've had with this episode is Gideon's going, she's innocent, she's innocent, she's innocent,
yeah.
she's innocent. And I'm going, okay, she's innocent for the crime. It still goes back to that. She's innocent for the crime for which she is going to go to the electric chair.
Yeah.
That does not mean, and it's never clear. So people have all sorts of different ideas. People got so mad at you.
Yeah.
Right.
For assuming she was involved in the murders.
Yeah. You know, they wanted
all
to
of these
write
girls.
It off.
Yeah. yeah.
They wanted to write it off. No, she didn't know. Give me a break.
There's no way.
You know, that yeah. she was so enthralled by him. And
I believe that an abused wife would look the other way for this kind of thing. But I don't believe she had no awareness. I believe that there was a breaking point when her child was in danger that she called the cops on him.
Yeah, well, I think, now here's the thing, because
Please.
So often what happens, in fact, was it Gone? Where they went and got a, no, it was some other episode. So often, right, They have a, we'll call it a come to Jesus moment, even if it isn't, right?
Right.
And they want to change the guilt. Everything else will affect one or the other of the partners.
Right.
In these things, right? I'm not so sure that, I hate to bring up Carla Homolka. There was guilt there. I have no, she got away with it.
Well, no, there's no question that there was guilt there. She's on the videotapes.
Yeah.
She got a deal because they hid the videotapes.
Well,
that's the only reason she got a deal.
Yeah, because the police and the DA gave her a deal before they found the videotapes.
Yep.
She never would have gotten a deal.
Of course
not. In this case, there were no videos.
No, exactly. There was no evidence about who. There was no concrete evidence about who did it. This fictional version.
Yeah, but there is the things that so bother me about this episode.
Yeah.
You know, like it's so creepy. Like some of the scenes, the scene with AJ, you know, and Michael Massey and the cards, right?
Yeah.
Playing the games of cards. He wants to touch your hair. You know, you just kind of, yeah. I mean, the creepiness of this episode, so many little, again, vignettes.
Yeah, there's this little moments that are very effective.
That are very, very, very effective. You know, and her mother, the woman who plays her mother.
Yeah.
Is extremely effective.
Oof.
The woman who...
It's a rough scene, yeah.
The woman who refused to look at the fact that, you know, her husband was sexually abusing her daughter and denies it to the end. And I'm going, okay, I've got, you know, like I'm going, okay, I can really, you know, but for the grace of God, right?
Yeah.
Never mind, it wasn't me. Just to let the audience know, it wasn't me, but it was my mother, and it was my grandmother.
Yeah.
Like I mean, why I have an attachment to some of these things.
Stories is because it's true in your life.
Yeah, there are personal aspects to it, and when I'm reading through it, and I go through my family history, I'm going, well, yeah, you know, there are things. Things could have been worse. This is a horrible, horrible situation.
Oh, God, yeah. And one thing that really interests me within that is they acknowledge something in this episode that they're going to shy away from later, which is the way childhood sexual abuse can completely warp that child's conception for the rest of their life of what sexuality is.
It's very funny because they use this idea of love maps, which I have... I have a problem all the time with the construct, but the idea is there, and it's actually earlier.
Yeah.
But that these things are set in stone, obviously, mm-hmm. Because all children, their relationships are based on the relationships their parents have, right?
Yeah.
And the rest of it. But yeah, no, they're going to shy away, and they're going to shy away from this idea of the love map, because. So often they talk about innocence. Drives me crazy. Absolutely drives me. I wish that word were stripped.
Yeah.
From the language.
Because it's just it's never that simple. It's never simple enough to just use that word. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But to get back to it, what happened, of course, was Janetta's character, right? I would say that once she was pregnant and then she had the child, that's when she probably started to change and couldn't take it anymore. And it's not just that her child was a threat.
Yeah.
But there's something that happens when you have a child. I would say most women, not all women.
Of course, not all women. There's plenty of women seriously, if you get murdered, your mother probably did it. It's not all women.
Yeah.
Like if a baby gets murdered, the mother did it. That's just... Statistically speaking, that's true.
Or the stepfather.
It does happen. I'm just saying, if a baby gets murdered, the parents did it, and it's more often than the mother than the father. So there you go. That's the upsetting true fact.
But not all
parents immediately come with maternal instincts, but they do exist.
Yeah. Okay, this... But what's interesting is this follows on the natural born killer.
Yes.
Because
that's true.
It does. And you're still seeing it's very clear that they're still keeping in mind this idea that somehow or another horrible, horrible childhoods create these people.
Right.
They're not born that way.
No.
Nothing. Now, and I find it, they don't, how can I put it? Because it's not like I don't think they should all be hung up by their toenails.
Of course. No. I mean,
that's not the point.
We're not saying they're not responsible for their actions.
No, but the thing is that that's something, they weren't born this way.
No.
Now, are there children who are born amoral? I don't know. Without morality, well, I don't know. Is there a part of the hippocampus? All of that crap.
Yeah.
Right now, I don't know. All I know is that even if you had a child, you have a hell of a lot of sociopaths, probably a hell of a lot of psychopaths in the world who don't go around murdering people and don't go around.
The vast majority of psychopaths never kill anybody.
Yeah,
it's the horrible abuse in childhood that turns them into murderers.
That fits in. And when you hear the murderers, and we never really get into any of that. There's probably a TV show that could do that.
Yeah.
They always want to sometimes, well, no, I shouldn't say. In the beginning of this show, they don't ever walk it back.
No.
John Douglas starts to walk it back periodically. And sometimes this show doesn't know, has forgotten that it had this idea that, first of all, these women who were massively sexually abused, and God only knows what happened to Michael Massey's character.
Yeah.
Because that's always harder, partly because men process their childhood
abuse completely differently. Yeah.
Than women. Yeah.
That being said, he was definitely abused as well. I mean, I think we can say that without any difficulty at all.
Yeah, and you can see it with the natural born killer. And that's where that the idea of a love map, I just hate the name, that idea comes
in.
It
is terrible.
Right? That your ideas are formed, and remind me to talk about that when we get to BTK.
Yeah.
Because it plays a role there that it doesn't in the episode. This one, I never understood, first of all, why Gideon was so bent on getting her.
Bound and determined to get her to, like, get her out.
Yeah. And how he could think that her issue was she was afraid of Michael. She knew.
Of course not.
He was going to die in the electric chair. He was never getting out. She was no longer bound to him.
Nope.
He thought she was, but
they hadn't seen each other in over a decade.
Yeah. Okay, and the best scene in this whole thing is when Hotch slams the picture of his son against the wall just before he dies.
Yeah.
That is the best scene in
the entire
episode.
It is.
And I don't even know if you talk about it in your
No, I don't think I did, but that is you're absolutely right. That's the best moment.
That is the best moment that somehow or another this guy didn't, that Hotch finally got him.
Yep.
With something, because he did tell him, right?
You want comeuppance for these characters. You really you do. You do. You want the comeuppance for them. And it's not much of a comeuppance, but it's there and it's real.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that about it.
Yeah, it's somehow or another very satisfying. I think Simon Mirren did a reasonably decent job, I think, of this. Given it's a difficult episode, but it's Mandy Patinkin, as we learn from the commentary.
Oh yeah, from the commentary, of course.
It's Mandy Patinkin
who
brought them the ending.
Yeah.
And they
because they were unclear about exactly how they should wrap up the episode.
And they kind of argued with him, they didn't think, and he was the one that created that ending.
Yeah.
And that she had to die.
Of course.
And it was so great, like,
And that's why I would never listen to people who tell me, oh, no, she had no idea. No, because she's not just willing to die. so her son doesn't have to live with who his parents were. She's willing to die because she's also guilty about all of the deaths she was partially responsible for.
Yeah, and people miss that line that Mirren gives her, which is, "My life ended the day I met Jacob."
Yep.
That says it all.
It's exactly right, because it lets you know that she feels responsible for his actions.
And the people he killed. And, you know, how involved she was is immaterial. She knew he was doing it.
She knew he was doing it, and she feels responsible.
Yeah.
You know,
her life ended the day she met Jacob. And
That's the key moment.
That's the key moment about why she is willing to die. And why he doesn't get it, I'm not sure. And that's the one thing that I wish they had addressed at least at some level in the episode.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't. They just don't. Well, yeah, but, you know, she did other things. She was this man's partner. And nobody even brings that up. There's no argument. Maybe it got cut for time. Maybe they had it in the original script. Sometimes I would love to be able to see the original scripts of these shows.
Wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be the best? Just get a look at the original scripts of those?
Yeah. Now, most of the time, I just wrote some book review things. Most of the time, when you get the unedited scripts, they're worse.
Or
the
unedited books. That's true.
They're worse. Like, it is pretty tight. It has boring moments, but I do think it explains a lot of things that it's okay. It's just, it's the acting, as you say, like with Tony Todd, Jeanetta Arquette, Michael Massey, turn this thing into, I think, a tour de force.
It's powerful.
That it should be.
No.
It shouldn't be, because it's not
that
well written. But it does have, once you start, you know, just when you let go of all of those problems, it's still, you get to the end, and I never fail to be emotionally moved by not so much the end where he sits watching the son play cello with the tear running down his face. That's nice, but it's not that. It's that he lets her die.
Yeah.
You know,
it's powerful.
It is powerful.
You're right. It's legitimately powerful.
Yeah. And
And that's the thing. And I think this is a perfect example for why I find so much to complain about in their formula, right? Because when they do an episode like this that actually does something different, it's some of their best work.
Yeah.
I didn't call it their best work at the time. But in retrospect, it absolutely is. Because the thing is, I mean, I watch a lot of good television. Having a good actor show up and put in a good performance, I don't think should raise the show up to the heavens. But considering what they would do later, I guess it kind of does.
Well, it's going to be very interesting when we get to the Tim Curry episode.
Yeah, well, no, but Tim Curry is another perfect example of that. Of, like, massively massively elevating what could be just the most blah stuff in the world.
Yeah, like it is, they seem to write very bland. And if anybody says actors, like that actors don't bring something to
the material,
the really good ones can turn, as they say, reading the telephone book.
It's true. And Michael Massey was fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean, I gave him a lot of crap for a lot of years for being the man who killed Brandon Lee. I did. But, I mean, he was always a very good actor. That's the thing. He was always quite powerful. He had a great voice, he had a great look, and he knew how to use what he had. Like, he is a man who totally understood what his look was, and he got the most out of it. So I think it's safe to say, like, I don't really have a problem saying that this is probably the best episode of the first season of Criminal Minds.
Yeah, I think that
And tell me if this is going too far, but if our theory that every season of Criminal Minds is worse than the season before it, Wouldn't that make the best episode of the first season of Criminal Minds the best episode of Criminal Minds?
Yeah, it would.
Well, I'm sure we're going to find some other good ones as we go, but this might be the best episode of Criminal Minds.
Well, seeing as I've watched, I just started watching. I didn't mention that in the beginning.
Season 13.
Season 13. And
it's even worse than season 12?
I watched the first episode of season 13, and I went, my good God.
How the mighty have fallen.
They are sleepwalking.
Don't tell me anything. But I mean, no, honestly, when I noticed that they care so, like, there's a point that might be the cutoff point. We have to look, when did they start using Washington, D.C. as an establishing shot for Quantico, Virginia? Because that might be when they just stop caring.
All I know is that most people stopped, like, people started getting angry about season 8.
Okay.
People start getting really angry and start stopping to watch the show, and all these people who are dying to listen to this podcast.
They all around season 8 are like, this filthy,
But so many of them, people still watch it, and they watch it through to the end, and it may be because what we're maybe finding is that you're still going to get some brilliant performances. Like, the only thing that I can think of is the Derek episode. That matches this for sort of consistent, because there are problems with that episode too.
Yeah, but use of tone and the performances.
And the performances, right? Yeah. But this one, and this
it's up there.
Is still brings up some of those issues, and it, I think what makes me want to shake their heads, right? Is look. You had the potential to move this forward. You've got so many things, even in earlier episodes than this one, that you could keep moving if maybe they needed to change up their writing staff.
That could have been it.
More, like maybe a new, I don't know. Anyway, we'll talk further about that later because...
Well, as we go through, as people come and go on the writing staff, which we are keeping track of, everybody.
Yes, Simon Buren leaves after season 3, I think.
We'll see. And we know Erica Messer takes over at some point. But that's, you know what, for quite a few episodes from now. Speaking of Erica Messer, she and her writing partner, Deborah J. Fisher, wrote episode 15, Unfinished Business, when a Philadelphia serial killer resurfaces after an 18-year absence. It should be year absence, and releases a statement threatening to claim another life in 5 days. The BAU works with now-retired FBI agent who spearheaded the original investigation to prevent him from making good on his threat. This is the one. Jeff Pearson plays a guy who's basically John Douglas. Really close to John Douglas. And on some level, I guess Jeff Pearson wasn't famous enough. I kind of wish he had just come back and not adding Joe Mantegna to the cast. He's a good actor. He's a strong presence, but I think his energy is too close to Greg's for that to work.
Yeah.
Long term. For one episode, it's fine to have him in there, and I'm a little sad he didn't get to do more when Mandy quit, but... You know, looking at the show of the interdynamics in the team, you needed someone less severe taking over for Mandy Patinkin. Mm-hmm. And you needed someone, you can't have someone like Greg in there just being a voice of authority. You need to have someone with a weird energy as well.
Yeah.
And that's what Joe Mantegna brings in season mm-hmm. 3. But Unfinished Business is just, I mean, the thing is, there's not a whole lot to discuss in the episode. It's weird how they catch him, in fact, because it's, like, I want to say, it shouldn't have been that hard. How do I put this? So they're like, he stopped for 18 years, and they're like, we know he was on a kill rampage, and then he disappeared for 18 years. And only now that he's back killing again, do we start thinking about reasons why he might have stopped. Like, and they're like, some people think he went to jail, but I think he's, you know, too egotistical to just sit in a jail cell without writing taunting letters. No, it had to be something else. And I'm like, well, you know roughly when he stopped. Could you not look into people who have been in comas, people who have been in accidents, people who have gone to jail? Like, why not just make a list of likely, like, sex criminals who went to jail? Like, if you're so passionate about solving this case, make a list of the sex criminals who went to jail or got into or had, you know, medical problems around that time. Because when they figure to do it in this episode, it takes them 8 minutes to find the killer.
Like, I don't know why they didn't think of that. Because, you see, but this gives it makes it easy for them to find it, because yeah,
the real story is so much harder to solve.
Yeah, well, the real story is, in some ways, much more interesting, because they never would have caught this guy, like BTK,
yeah,
if he hadn't come out of the woodwork for yes. whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, and there's books written about why he came back.
Well, I think
there's whole books.
Well, I think John Douglas, though.
What is John
right.
Douglas's theory? Because you just read the book.
Okay. I think Douglas is right about this part of it, that this guy got scared.
Yeah.
That he was going to be caught. And the reason why, and his wife, first of all, he was a cross-dresser.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And his wife caught him.
Oh.
And she talked to him, and they had a little bit of therapy, and he was never going to, well, he didn't want therapy, but, you know, she talked around, and they said, well, you know, he promises never to do it again.
Oh, sorry, pause. I closed a thing. Hold on. Just going to make a note of where I have to edit. Edit at 41:50. So I just go back to I'll say they never do about going into therapy, and then you just get back to the wife. Okay? One second. Well, they never do.
No. Yeah, and she gets advice that you know, as long as, and he promised, she doesn't want to talk to anybody about it. She doesn't talk about sex, etc. I mean, she's the perfect wife for a serial killer, because, you know, she just doesn't know what to do with this, and she trusts him, and he backs off, and yes, he did have all sorts of stuff hidden in his home, but yeah. You don't get the impression that it was, and I'll get to that in a minute, that it was necessarily hidden away, or he had a place, as this guy does, where yeah. his wife can't go, right?
Yeah, a secret room.
Yeah, where this guy can't go. Now, BTK tries to hide everything. Anyway, and then there's some really... and then he actually calls something in, right? He calls one of his murders in.
Yeah.
And they put that phone call on the air. And his wife... And this is later. And his wife makes this joking remark.
That it sounds like him.
It sounds like him.
Jesus.
Yeah. And then they put some of his writing up. And
yeah.
And bizarrely enough, she never sees it.
Oh, no. So she already had this back of her mind suspicion because of the voice, but she never saw the writing sample.
Yeah, she just she kind of laughed it off.
But had she seen the writing sample as well,
she would have gone, just like with Unabomber.
Yep.
She probably would have then
would have
gone,
called somebody to just check.
Yeah, it's a case, right? It's a case of, or she would have confronted him and he might have killed her. But it's a case
yeah,
of you never expect somebody you know.
No, of course not. And they covered that on last week's episodes. But it's like you want to ask for witnesses, not for killers, because nobody wants to think they know a killer. Which is I mean that's good. That's a good observation about how psychology works.
Yeah, and this was the thing, and so Douglas says this is probably he just got scared.
Yeah.
Really, really scared that he would get caught, and it would be his wife who caught him.
Yeah.
And she had already told him that she would walk out on him if she ever found him cross-dressing again.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Right? And when he gets caught, she walks out and never has anything to do with him again. Different for his children, but yeah. She never has anything to do with him again.
Huh.
Well, outside of the, I mean.
Well, yeah, outside of, you know, parental, like, court-based stuff and having to talk to the police and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and she never
wow.
did.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, and that house was still, I don't know if it's still there, but the house that he lived in was still there when Douglas went back to take a look at it. But, wow. Yeah, that's Douglas, and that, to me, makes a lot of sense, even though, you know, because they've got all of these images of these serial killers and how they can't stop and they're disorganized and they go into frenzies and blah, 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 blah. And this guy clearly...
He stopped.
He stopped.
He stopped for, you know, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
He just stopped.
He just stopped cold. Now, you know, what he had. Now, yeah, because, you know, he had all of his drawings.
Right, because he would do drawings of the crime scenes, yeah.
He could map them all out, he could do all of this stuff, but he kept them, he had these horrible pictures, there's all
it's truly
sorts
upsetting.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is that his daughter, and Douglas wants to go away from this, is getting us away from this particular episode, which we'll get back to,
yeah.
But his daughter had nightmares for years and years and years and years. And again,
before having any idea.
What? Yeah, but she's still writing different things because he's now sort of denying just garbagey stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But the daughter has had, and she has written, and she's talked about this and about forgiving her father. And then, well, he was, because by all accounts, he was an upstanding, outstanding father.
Weird.
Except that these nightmares, nobody could figure it out. And she found her dad's stash.
Yeah.
And then turned this into a monster when she was little. Like, I mean, 6 or 7 years old or something.
Right. And so she saw the pictures.
Probably.
And
yeah.
She couldn't intellectualize what they were. So it became this just horrible part of her mind that her brain tried to process for the rest of her life.
Well, yeah, and she would have these monsters that were coming to kill her and things like that. She had these horrible images. And I'm just going, oh, my God. You know, why isn't she getting therapy for this?
Damn.
Because when you read her take and discussion, because you can go back and read things in the newspapers and stuff, I don't know where she is now. But
yeah.
It's clear she is still like 10 years later and 15
wow.
years later after finding. The son is a little more stable. But,
yeah.
I mean, this again goes to what we were just talking about, is that they're created. Like, and Douglas
yeah.
wants to dismiss that. With
he always does, yeah. He really does.
With BTK, he wants to kind of, well, you know, he says there's something, you know, he has this vague picture of his mother being entangled up in sheets at some point when he was like maybe 2 or 3 years old, and that stuck in his head. And then there are, you know, and then Douglas just wants to go, well, yeah, but you can't believe anything he says. And I'm going, no, 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 how can you walk away from what is an obvious connection between what he did.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure, of course, what he saw, because I can tell you stories from some of my clients.
Yeah.
That are, and you're just sort of sitting there.
Well,
going,
you shouldn't tell us stories from some of your clients.
No,
you could, but you won't.
But I won't. But let
yeah.
me tell you that they have all of these screen memories, and when you get behind those screen memories and you get closer to what are the real memories, you don't want to know.
Well, and that's the thing. When children are making memories, they don't understand how the world works. So if they see something that they can't understand, it can get essentially it can get recorded to the wrong part of the brain, and so you will remember a more innocent version of what actually happened because you just don't have the framework to process what was really going on.
Yeah, and yeah, it's that simple. And there's no way, and because it's sort of hidden, it can come out, because there are always continuing issues, and then there are all of these parents. The problem is that so often, because you have all of this Christian upbringing that says spare the rod and spoil the child.
Yeah.
So many of these children, these men, were physically abused.
Yeah.
Massively as punishment.
And they're told by society to interpret it as how you were correctly raised.
Oh, yeah, not only that, you know, but it's, I'm doing this for your own good.
Oh, my
this
God.
This is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me.
Hurt me than it hurt me more than it hurts you, yeah. That ridiculous lie.
Yeah, that ridiculous lie. And so you see it time and time and time again. And there is nothing more effective to bind a child to the parent than that kind of abuse, because it sets it up, and it sets it up for life.
Yeah.
So, and then you add the sexual component, as they say, within that love map context.
The love map, yeah. It warps it all the further.
It warps it all the further, and in some of these, it's so bad that the warping is, well, just ends up. And there is no undoing that.
No, that can't be fixed. You can treat it, and you can get counseling, and you can live a good life, but you can't fix that. The way your brain works is not going to work. You don't even think they can take the drugs and keep themselves calm.
No. Because particularly the earlier it is, the more likely that you've got some form of split personality.
Right.
Or what we've got a nice fancy name, but what most people think of as multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
The earlier it begins, the more capable.
The way people dissociate.
Yeah. It what happens is that they dissociate and create different parts of themselves. So
to wall off the trauma, essentially.
Yeah, but it's still there, and it's not interconnected, and it can come back. It's not always three faces of Eve.
No, of course not.
And she had a hell of a lot more personalities than those three.
Yeah.
But what happens is that we know that with some of these people that some of them can have diseases and another personality doesn't have it in
the same
friggin' body.
Yeah.
Right?
It's there's impressive stuff.
It is so rare. And let's face it, serial killers, in the sense that we're talking about here, are rare.
Yeah, incredibly.
I mean, Criminal
rare.
Minds makes you think that they're all over the place, but they are rare.
Now, unbelievably rare.
And they're horrible, and they're god-awful.
Yeah.
But they're rare, and it's just like true multiple personality disorders are really rare. I mean, that is, we are talking about complete dissociation from one part to another part. And most therapies don't, like, therapies for multiple personality disorders, and you can't even get to them with these guys.
Yeah.
Like, because most people will say, well, yeah, but these guys, so many of them were never abused. Like, Douglas, with BTK, well, yeah, but, you know, we don't seem to have a history.
Why would you have a history? Do you think someone was going to the cops about this kind of abuse?
Yeah. And that he
spoiler alert, when parents beat their children, they don't call the cops on themselves. You know, if you didn't beat it bad enough to get a hospital report, there's not going to be, you're never going to know this abuse happened.
Well, yes. And in those days, just because you brought a child to the hospital for a bone and a broken arm and this, that, and the other thing, well, they were just prone to falling.
They fell off of a thing. It happens. You know how clumsy kids are.
Yeah, you know.
That's what we heard all of the time.
Tripping over his own feet all the time.
Yeah, like now we know better, but at the time people were very credulous when it came to parenting.
Mm-hmm.
They would defer to whatever the parents said. If the parents said, "This is the way I'm raising my child," you would give them so much deference.
Well, no,
you would have to start putting out cigarettes on your child before people would look at you askew, before they say, okay, that's child abuse. And that is the stereotypical child abuse for a reason. It's because anything short of that wasn't considered abuse.
Well, no, because disciplining your child, you were allowed, right?
Legally,
to hit your child. The business of getting rid of corporal punishment was unbelievable, and it is still one of those things that all of these friggin' Christian fundamentalists think is just fine. Hit your kid. They preach it. And I mean, I can remember reading court cases, right, where when the judge would say, I guess you just didn't take him behind the woodshed enough.
Jesus.
What? And
if only you had beaten your child more effectively, they wouldn't turn into a criminal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you got that backwards, actually, but okay.
Okay, but that was an acceptable.
No, that was thing. And so yeah, you're right. We can't know what kind of torture created BTK because it was not thought of as such.
There are, as I said, a few things when you're going through. Like I have a whole stack of notes in my book.
And theories about this.
Well, there are a few things here, right, where you just know that there's something going on there that he managed to completely wipe from himself, because he was a totally dissociated human being.
Right.
There's no way that he could. He was like this perfect minister guy. He was a good worker. He was, you know, I mean,
like an attentive father, apparently.
Yeah, because you know, and a reasonably attentive wife, a wife who wasn't overly upset with
him all the time, like did not.
Nope.
Like she, yeah, and but at the same time, he's got this monstrous second life.
Yeah.
And this insane fantasy about creating, you know, slaves for the afterlife.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I mean, he might have just cut and pasted that from Zodiac's letter, but he still wrote it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy wrote an entire manifesto of his belief about how the universe worked.
Oh, jeez, yeah. Well,
I mean, I've never read it, but I know it's out there.
Well, and he was, like, he just, it is in that he couldn't make those kinds of connections. And the fact that he could stop and survive on his fantasies for 20 years.
Two decades, yeah.
Yeah, you know, because, well, first of all, not only did he not want, and I would suspect it, he would have lost his, not only would he have been caught if his wife had figured it out, but the very fact that she found him cross-dressing, right?
Yeah.
And she just was having no part of this, and he didn't want to lose his wife, he didn't want to lose his children, he didn't want to lose all of the things that made him a, quote, normal human being.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, I don't want to profile the man too thoroughly, but you want to look at like a stereotypical reaction of the abused child trying to figure out how to live. Look for someone who is absolutely determined to achieve all of the, you know, cultural signposts of normalcy.
Yeah, and well, yeah.
Look for that guy and you might be looking in the same direction.
Yeah, it's a very interesting because you can't even diagnose with borderline disorder and stuff, this sort of thing,
right.
Because that's what people with borderline disorders, but they tend to develop much later. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, so we're going to circle around back to the episode for our weekly check-in, and how terrible was L this week? Seriously, did you watch the deleted scene that's on the DVD?
Yes.
It's literally just her complaining about having to take orders from some guy she's never met. Like, this guy founded the BAU. He founded the place you work. He's caught serial killers. He just wrote a book about it. Everybody respects him. And the deleted scene is just her bitching about having to take orders from someone she doesn't know.
I couldn't, but yeah, I don't. Yes.
I'm glad they cut it from the episode, but wow, is Elle the worst?
Yes, we can see why she's going to be gone.
Yeah, oh no, it's just the whole, the team has to have a certain trust each other to work, and I'm like, stop being so dramatic. You know, you sit in a room, you spitball theories, and then Garcia finds out who did it. Yeah. You're not a baseball team, okay? Because that's what happened this week. Garcia found out who did it. Also, I like that after... So, the BTK killer in this episode leads them to another murderer.
Yeah.
Right? And they don't really ask you, hey, who do you think turned you in?
Yeah.
And they don't like, well, let's tear that guy's life apart until we find BTK, because the only way BTK could have known to point him is if they knew each other. BTK wasn't going out trying to solve murders, because nobody knew this guy was killing people, meaning he had to know him personally.
Yeah.
And
okay.
He did. So, but it's like, it's weird how they're like, he led us to a killer. Oh, well, it's not like this is evidence to help us find him. Of course it's evidence to help you find him. Tear that guy's life apart until you find him. And then the minute they find BTK, they're like, oh, well, he worked with that guy. There you go. Seems like you could have found him an hour faster had you just checked into that guy's, who was in his jail cell in prison, who did he work with, who was he friends with. Like, just go and find out. You know?
Yeah.
And if they had just been friends, it might have been hard for Garcia to find out. But no, they worked together, which would have been easy for Garcia to find out. Did he work with any sex offenders? He did? Done. You're done. You know? But yeah, she always solves the case. So, thing is, it's not a great episode, but it is interesting in the way it handles. And I think the fact that we went down this 20-minute tangent about the abuse and about the fact that he stopped just shows you how hard it is to do fiction, right, about, especially in this, the short subject 40-minute episodes that Criminal Minds does, how hard it is to do something as complicated as BTK. Because a man stops killing for 20 years, right? When everything you know about serial killers says they don't stop.
Yeah.
So how do you do an episode about how do you do an episode without upending your entire franchise, without upending the structure of the show? And you do it by saying, oh no, here's a concrete physical reason. Like, this is supposed to be a show. It has Criminal Minds in the title. But we don't want to start talking about psychology here. He was just in a car accident. It's fine. That's why he stopped.
Because, yeah. I mean, yeah, and that's interesting because you don't get the impression that his wife was like the wife of the killer in
Dennis Ray.
Unfinished Business.
Oh, I thought you meant this is Unfinished Business. The real life one.
The real life wife yes. was like the wife in Unfinished Business.
No, not at all.
She certainly didn't seem to be afraid of her husband. She didn't have any of these questions. You know,
no,
there was
and
nothing.
It's like, and what I love is, like, has your husband been depressed for 20 years and recently he came out of it and didn't, why? He's been depressed. Why are they still married if he's been in a funk for 20 years? Come on.
Yeah.
Like, apparently, if we're being asked to believe that this guy has just been, like, moping around like Eeyore for 20 years until he was physically strong enough to kill again. Like, come on, no. Like, as you point out, Dennis Rader had a full life.
Yeah.
He was an asshole to everybody he had power over because he couldn't stop himself from doing that. And, you know, he's a serial killer. But...
Yeah. But other than that, it's no wonder nobody figured him. It was him.
No, because he had a full life. He was just a guy in the community. He was a deacon in the church.
Yeah.
My favorite part about how he was caught, so he sends them the manifesto. He sends them the manifesto of, like, his crazy belief about how the universe works. And they're like, and he's like, can I send you a disc? I don't want to have to, like, print 500 pages. Is there any way to trace a disc? And they're like, no, of course not. Send it on and we'll read your manifesto. And he's like, okay. Dropping a disc in the mail, so he sends them the disc. And then they're like, disc, open file, because it's Microsoft Word. Who was the last person to edit this document? Dennis at the Faith Hope Trinity Church. Dear Faith Hope Trinity Church, do you have somebody there whose name Dennis? You mean Dennis Rader, the church deacon? That's who it is. Thanks.
bye.
That's all it took. That's how they caught him. They had no idea who it was.
However, he goes on and on being pissed off forever about how the police lied to him.
I thought we were playing a deadly game of cat and mouse.
No, I thought we were friends and I could trust you and you understood me. Like,
you're a crazy murderer. Of course we don't value you.
Yeah, yes. Well, you know, that's
pretty funny.
A little lack of self-awareness there about how the world
works. Lack of
works.
Self-awareness. He thought he was involved in a deadly game of cat and mouse with cops who saw him as an equal. And that's not at all what was happening. At all. All right, so that is the story of BTK and also the story of Unfinished Business.
Well, yeah.
Here's
one thing.
Oh, one thing?
I don't know where you were going to go because we don't discuss this ahead of time.
Of course, yeah.
Is what I was, like, I'm watching this interaction between John, like the John Douglas character.
Yeah.
And the rest of the team, right?
Yeah.
And the way he's portrayed. Right, mm-hmm. He's retired, but he can't stay away from it. Which, of course, John Douglas, by the point BTK was caught, had been when was he caught? 2004, 2002, something like that. Finally,
yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and he'd already been retired for ages and basically was moping around because he'd lost his. I'll tell you the John Douglas story. I mean, he'd lost his kind of edge. He didn't have anything to write about anymore and whatever. And then BTK gets caught.
And he's like, boom, I'm back, baby.
Yeah, that's basically it, right? Boom, I'm back, baby. But what's really interesting is the FBI liaison to this show is a guy by the name of Jim Clemente.
Right, who has written episodes.
Later on, he writes
later
episodes.
Later on, yeah.
Okay? And I'm sitting there, as I'm reading, as I'm sort of watching the show, I've read the book, and I'm going, I really wonder whether John Douglas's interaction after he left.
Yeah.
Because he never really left the business. Like
no,
he
of
just,
course not.
You know, he just, he that is clear from him. He has his own issues with, he just can't let it go. But he has the, Douglas has the nightmares. He has a lot of problems. There's no question. He doesn't shy away from saying some of it.
No.
But yeah, whether or not his interaction with FBI agents was perceived by the BAU in real life the same way that, like, did they perceive John Douglas the way this guy is written?
That's a really good question.
Did Jim Clemente have some input into how this was going to...
How they were going to react to him. That's a good question.
How this was going to be structured, because, as I said, he goes on to write the odd episode later on, and
We'll pay much closer attention to those episodes and other ones, because they're written by an actual FBI agent. I wonder how they're going to stack up. Don't tell me which ones they are. I'm interested to find out. So next week, if you're watching along with us, we're going to be talking about three more episodes, and those episodes are number 16, The Tribe, where they work with, what is it, Sheriff Black Wolf.
Oh yeah, the
my
best
favorite my favorite character ever on the show, Sheriff Black Wolf. Episode 17, A Real Rain, which is their vigilante episode. And episode 18, Somebody's Watching, their stalker episode, which I'm very excited to talk about, because there's a thing in this episode where, like, when they were writing it, they had such a great idea for the script. And then when they made the prop... And I'm hinting pretty heavily here, but when they made the prop, they botched it so badly that it completely ruins the effect they were going for. And we will talk about that. I've been purposefully oblique, so you can be nicely surprised when you watch it yourself if you've never seen it. So I guess that's that. For more from me, obviously the Criminal Mind reviews go up Fridays on Varjalan.com. There's stuff at the Hidden Object Guru YouTube channel. Sheila, a place they can read your writings?
Do you really want to read my writings? I don't think so. But you can
all right.
drag me.
I'll try and... Me. Okay, good. I was like, do I have to drag it out of you, or are you just going to tell us?
Oh, well, yeah, SheilaRedman.com. I mean,
yeah, there you go. Yeah.
There you go. Go read SheilaRedman.com.
Check it out.
Get some of my backstory.
Thoughts on various hot button issues in the religious studies community. And let's face it, ever since Spotlight, the religious studies community is the hot place to be writing.
Well, I don't do as much as, I mean, after all, I mean, I still haven't read the Pennsylvania 100 and 1,000 and some odd pages. I will start writing about that once I start reading it, but it's going to be a while.
That's a rough one to dig into.
Except I will say that this is the first time that the FBI's basically sex crimes, child sex crimes unit was brought in to
work on the Priestley stuff.
To work on the Priestley stuff.
Which is fantastic.
Which is actually a good thing, because that has been one of my real things. I'm sorry, they're child predators. Why?
They are, and it's an organization of child predators covering up for each other.
Yeah, and why aren't you calling it this? Well, because, like the rest of the world, Criminal Minds doesn't go there. Ever.
Okay. All right, and on that note, we will see you back here next week for more Criminal Minds.
Au revoir. Adamant. That's the smart. Anyway. Yeah, goodbye.
Bye.